At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Okay, folks, welcome, and not just welcome to what you're listening to, but welcome from Leslie Ann and myself, Planet Porky. That's where you've arrived by tuning into this podcast. We're delighted to have you. And Leslie Ann, once again, some great interaction with the listeners from our last podcast. You've had a few real fiery exchanges, and I have to say, you know, when it gets to that stage, we're winning. People, it's getting through people's ears to the other side of their head.
I'm loving it. Absolutely good. Loving the messages good. And the interactions. Yeah, thank you. Keep them coming.
Excellent. We will keep it coming indeed. Look, and folks, listen, by the way, thank you for all the you know, the messages and all that. Keep them coming. And we better remind people that we're live soon on the stage at the Hen and Chickens, which is marvellous.
Sunday the Northam. 5th of April.
Sunday 5th of April, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Tickets are selling very well, folks, and if you want to come along and see us, then it would be great to see you.
Oh, we're going to have a drink in the bar afterwards.
Oh, absolutely.
It'd be very nice to meet some of you who've so kindly been in
touch. It certainly will. The show kicks off at 3, be, you know, right the way through till, when I say right the way through, continuous, there's no break, till about 4:10, and then we all go downstairs and we have a few sherbets. So we're looking forward to that. Now, for the last couple of podcasts, Leslie Ann, we haven't spoken about the subject which nobody can get away from in this country, and that, of course, is Harry and Meghan. Yeah. Now, a week ago, the latest development was they were rather forthright and uptight with the Queen for saying, you can't tell us not to use royals, but I tell you what, we won't use royal anyway. Harry then arrives back in this country looking very sombre and very, well, reflective, in my view. Do you think it's dawning on him yet, the enormity of what he has done, extricating himself from the British family to pursue what more and more commentators are saying is Meghan's vision of life and not Harry's?
Absolutely, I do. I think he's regretting everything.
Yeah.
It was spiteful of them to say of Her Majesty, she doesn't own the word royal.
Now, yeah.
Of course she doesn't own the word,
yeah.
But the fact is, Harry is born a prince. Mm. He's born into the royal family.
Yes.
So, you know, he is part of that clan.
Yes.
Whatever Meghan wants him to be now, you can't eradicate your roots and your birthright and your heritage.
Yes.
And it's so deeply offensive to Her
Indeed.
Majesty the Queen
Indeed.
That I've actually turned in my opinions against them.
Yeah.
Let Meghan go off to America and have a Hollywood career. I mean, it's about time she started having one. She never had one in the first place.
Yes.
You know, now that she's got the baby, she's holding all the cards.
Yep.
She has the power.
Yes.
I truly, honestly hope that their marriage doesn't disintegrate.
Yeah.
But I cannot see a role for Harry in America.
Yeah.
I think that everything they're trying to do with him is fake.
Yeah, I can't as well. And the other one that you said about Hudson's role in America, his role in America will be two paces behind her if she gets her way.
And that's what she didn't like about having to walk behind Kate in this country.
Yeah. Yeah.
Surely somebody sat her down and explained the routine to
Meghan.
That's
right. That's
surely
right.
They did.
Yeah, this is the way things are done
she
in this country.
She wanted the big fairy tale wedding. We
yes.
were talking about that, weren't we,
yes.
before? She wanted the princess wedding, but she didn't want to do her duty.
No, absolutely.
And the thing is, the royal family is all about duty. We had Her Majesty.
She doesn't understand that, though.
Her Majesty, 93, going in and talking to MI5 recently.
And
she's still out there on the job.
Yeah.
She's still doing what she was born to do.
Well, yeah,
and Harry should be too.
Absolutely.
Sorry.
In fact, the last few pictures I've seen of Kate, she's looking more glamorous than ever. She wears those. Like
she's upped her game.
Is it Marco Blanano shoes? What are they called?
Manolo Blahnik.
Manolo Blahnik.
She's very beautiful and she's very dignified.
She's becoming more and more better looking. I totally agree with you. As time
goes on, William's losing more and more hair.
Well.
Will he be our first bald king, do you think?
Well, probably. But, I mean, you can't help that, can you? I mean, I didn't start losing my hair fortune until I was quite late into my middle age.
Oh, you've got loads of hair.
Middle age. I haven't got loads of hair, unfortunately. But I just have to... And sometimes
do I need new glasses?
Sometimes when I do television, the girls in the makeup room always, you know, style it very nicely for me to make me look like I've got more. Now, something that I've only just picked up on happened a few days ago. Ricky from EastEnders, okay? Are you a big EastEnders fan?
No, not at all.
But you must have been in the 80s because
when it first came out.
Everybody like you in the showbiz world were told every day, I want a bleeding EastEnders story.
Absolutely.
Right?
So I used to follow around Anita Dobson.
Yes.
She was the one I was tailing.
Right.
And of course, she was having an affair with Brian May from Queen.
Oh,
and so I was
really?
Very close to the Queen camp. So I was set on her trail.
Yeah.
And I remember being up in the roof gardens. Do you remember the roof
gardens? Yeah, of course I do.
On top of the old Derry and Toms building.
Oh, the roof garden. Hang on, have I got the right one? The roof garden's not next to
Kensington
Palace. Yes, of course I do. Yeah.
So we'd be down there. And
Roof
it was
Garden
Flamingos.
Hotel,
It wasn't a hotel. It used to be where...
Did Branson take it over eventually?
And
Beagle was there at one point.
And it was Derry and Toms, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, that's right.
And
yeah.
it had this wondrous sort of Italianate garden on the top with
with
a little lake and a river.
Yes, that's right.
And a little sort of summer house in the corner where Mel Smith was always snorting coke down there holding court.
Yeah.
And she was up there and she and Brian May had this tryst in a bush.
Right.
And I witnessed this, you see. So I they had a tryst in a bush.
That was a bush in the roof gardens.
Well, yeah, it's gardens, it's
trees
and bushes.
That's true,
and all the rest.
It is,
You're absolutely right.
He was
married at the time.
Yeah.
She wasn't married, but he was married to Chrissy.
Mm.
And in fact, he and I had babies at this more or less the same time. So I was sort of following this very closely.
Yes.
It was obvious they were having an affair.
Right, yeah.
Deny. They were lying through their teeth about it.
Yes.
Left, right and centre.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to her, come on, you and Brian. And she said, you'll have to talk to my agent about that.
Right.
Which was the classic line, wasn't it, really?
Was she married to anybody else at the time?
No, she wasn't.
Was Brian?
Yes, he was married to Chrissy.
Who's Chrissy? Sorry.
His wife.
And had she been with him through the growth of the Queen fame pop years?
No, they hadn't long met, actually. But
really?
They sort of, their eyes had met across a crowded...
No, I'm talking about Brian May and his wife.
Oh, God, they'd been together for donkeys.
That's what I mean, since he came out of university or something.
Well, they'd been together a long, long time.
Yeah,
and they had four kids.
Yeah.
But,
I always found that a very strange unison that, you know, one of the most famous soap actresses of the day with a rock star of the day.
Well, they looked the same. If you remember, they had the same hair and everything. And the joke was always who gets to the hairdryer first.
Yes, that's right,
Actually, neither of them, because look at the hair.
Yeah.
But anyway, we digress. We were talking about Sid.
Yeah, well, we were talking about Sid. Now, Rick I. Yeah, what's his name? Sid what?
Sid someone.
Yeah, Sid somebody. He goes off to... he's somewhere in the Far East. I think it's like Thailand or somewhere. And he's playing golf. He's a golfer. And golfing nightmare, he gets a ball in the gob and knocked out six of his teeth, fractured his jawbone and fractured the bone under his eye.
Oh, that's nasty.
Absolutely horrendous.
Poor guy.
But it sort of, you know, this happened a few days ago, but it's kind of now that he was actually in a retreat trying to get his head together at the time, and instead he got his head taken apart. You see what I mean?
Oh, so the golf was just a cover for...
Oh, no. He was playing golf to relax. He was genuinely there, but he'd gone all
that
way. Not
on the 19th hole, was he, by any chance?
No, he wasn't, no. And in fact, it was one of the worst golf injuries you can actually get, because the ball didn't come from somebody teeing off 100 yards away. It was somebody very closer to him hit a ball which hit a tree and ricocheted into Ricky's face.
So ricocheted.
Ricky's face. So there would have been a tremendous amount of power in it, you know, and smashed all his face could have killed him. In the actual original story a few days ago said if it had been 2 inches high, it would have killed him, okay?
Yeah.
But what I was going to say is EastEnders, now I was the news editor when that came out, and the guy we often mentioned, Sir Nicholas Lloyd, was the new editor of the Express.
Sirlik.
Yeah, that's right. And he was very close to Michael Grade, who I think was controller of the BBC at the time.
Yeah, he was. Great friend of my dad's, yeah.
That's right, absolutely, yeah. And so it was obvious, because you used to see Michael Grade coming in out of the building, that Nick was doing Michael Grade a favour by putting EastEnders on the front page every day.
Yeah.
I mean, every day, record numbers.
It was relentless, wasn't it?
Utterly relentless. Because what Michael Grade had done is, did he invent it, Michael Grade? Did he invent EastEnders?
I think he did. Did he?
I think he did. And the whole idea was that for, like, even then, for 30 years, ITV, the commercial stations, had Coronation Street. And then they started Brookside, which was on Channel 4, I think. That was Phil, what's his name, you know, from Liverpool, Phil whatever. And they decided, look, we've got to have a soap. They didn't have any soaps. Oh, they had Emmerdale Farm. Yeah. The commercial division had that.
That was rubbish, wasn't it?
Oh, terrible. I like it these days, though.
Oh, I don't watch it.
Since they stopped calling it a farm and called it Emmerdale, it's great. Anyway, point of my story is...
Neighbours, that was the other one, wasn't it?
Sorry. Oh, Neighbours, of course, that was imported. That was commercial, wasn't it? That was on ITV, wasn't it? Yeah. So they decided. So somebody came up with this brilliant idea, EastEnders. Although I can't stand it because it's too London for me. You know what I mean? Being a northern boy, I'm being unkind because some people can't stand Coronation Street because it's too northern. You know, it's you are Kevin. Hey, Kevin, get car out.
Foreign
garage,
language,
you know,
isn't
all
it?
That. Yeah, but. No, Nick said to me, I was a newsie, I said, I want a front page story every day. I mean, when I say a front page story, I don't mean the splash every day, but he wanted the second story or the picture story always to be on EastEnders. And it was absolutely madness, the popularity of it. I think there was like 22 million people watched the Christmas Day version that year when Dirty Den handed over the divorce papers to Angie, you know, who you've just been talking about, you know, running off with Brian May. And to this day, I still don't get it, but
it's
people
do. It's a sad indictment on the intelligence of the population
well,
at large, isn't
maybe,
it?
Maybe.
Because these people are, guess what, make-believe. They don't exist.
And
they're
it's
actors.
Only make-believe. Well, it
but
might
why,
be. But
why are we so hooked? Or why, I say we, because I don't watch it, but why is the nation so hooked
well, it gets us
on a bunch of fairy tale characters?
Well, you say fairy tale characters, but it gets us out of our routine lives, doesn't it?
And
you,
are they reflective of real life?
EastEnders recently, although I didn't watch it, they had a 35th anniversary or something like that. So for a whole week, they had like an hour long show each night. And I read the reviews of it. It was so ridiculous. You know, people in the space of a few hours were kidnapped and then released and then killed and then in car crashes and then ran off with somebody's wife and then somebody shot somebody.
Because every episode needs a cliffhanger.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a bit like a column, you know. Every single one has to end on, oh, my God, I need to come back and see what happened.
Yeah.
Why do you? Because it's made up.
That's right.
Some writer sat around and invented it.
I've been a Coronation Street devotee for many, many years. Now, we can't go a podcast or two, because we haven't mentioned it in the last two, about your great friend, Mad Liz Jones, OK?
Oh, we love Liz Jones.
Because it's getting even madder now. The last
She's breaking off her engagement, hasn't she?
That's her last column I read. Yeah. And we've said this before, that poor guy's life is, you know, spread all over her column
every
week.
He was not worthy of her. She's far too good for him.
And now she's sent the ring back.
She tried to take it back to the shop.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't take it back because
two reasons.
And it had been altered.
Yeah.
But she said she didn't want the money. She wanted them to pay it back to his credit card. But they wouldn't do that.
Yes.
But it had been altered.
Yes.
So I get that bit.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure I get any of it really because... You know, I've never been in such an extraordinary... I mean, this relationship, this guy she's talking about, started 35 years ago, didn't it?
No, yeah, but they weren't together for all that time. They only recently...
No, she was lusting after him, though, all that time. Because she knew him as a kind of student or something.
It's a bit of a last-ditch attempt, though, isn't it?
Well,
if you get back together with somebody that you knew all that time ago.
I agree.
I mean, if it wasn't right, it didn't work out.
That's right.
There was a very good reason for it not working out.
Yes.
So you don't then go back to it.
No,
30-odd years later.
I see what you mean. Have you, in fact, had this meeting and lunch with Liz yet? Because
no,
I want to know
yet.
What she's
and it's
like.
It's entirely my fault. She's delightful. We ran into each other at a Christmas party.
Yes.
And it was very funny because she, I introduced myself to her.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, you're Leslie Ann Jones. You're the one I always blame when I get something wrong in an entertainment story. And I always say, no, it wasn't me, it was her. So we had a good laugh about that.
So your byline's on the story.
So I'm her fall guy.
So Liz has written something in a column about something, you know, people then challenge her. And she said, well, it wasn't me, it was Leslie Ann Jones. Well, that's nice, isn't it?
I thought that was very sweet.
Yeah.
So we did say we'd have lunch, but I've been manically working to deadline on a book, which finally is finished. Mm. So I do need to email her and fix up that lunch.
Well, I think you should. And talking about people sort of in the limelight, do you know anything about Sue Perkins?
As in Mel and Sue?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
a little bit.
And as in the Bake Off and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I hated Bake Off. I didn't watch that. But I do rather like Sue Perkins.
Okay, well, I read, only recently, some Showbiz magazine, that a fourth show, and I'm not having a go at Sue Perkins. She's been very successful on television. A fourth show, which they commissioned for her. Trouble is, some of these broadcasters, they sign you up, don't they? And then they try a show that
doesn't
work.
They don't know what to do with you. Yeah.
Exactly, and then give it... There's some guy called Rahani or something on one of the channels, and they keep giving him travel shows and all this kind of stuff, and then something else. And I think she's had a contract. So I've read that the fourth show that's been sort of built around her has suddenly been cut short, you know? Now, I feel very sorry for that situation, because what happened was, just giving you a potted history of how we all have to be so careful with our careers, Bake Off moved from the BBC... to Channel 4, didn't it?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, and there was that whole controversy surrounding Paul Hollywood.
That's right, absolutely. She decided not to go with it, and I think Mary Berry did as well, didn't she?
Wasn't
she
right.
the star of the show? Mm-hmm. And the show has survived, but those who didn't go with it are losing their identity. Now, do you understand what I'm saying? It's a critical career decision.
So they swore allegiance to the channel who originally brought them in.
Absolutely.
You can't do it.
Absolutely.
You've got to be
cutthroat.
Instead
of to the production company that made
it, you
know what I mean?
You've got to be cutthroat. You've got to go with the show that made you. So, it's an unfortunate thing, but...
Oh, it's terrible. It's happened to me. You know, I've thought, I'm going to show loyalty here. And you make a decision and you lose an opportunity and then you find that was a wrong mistake. Because sometimes you do it to be loyal to somebody else in the business.
No such thing as loyalty.
Who then, 3 weeks later, suddenly, bonf, the knife's in your back and you're out. You know what I mean?
Jean Rooke famously said, always cross the street for more money.
Yes.
And she had no compunction about...
She came from the Mail to the Express.
Yeah. If the Express offered her more dosh to come and do the same job, she's going to go. She's not going to stay loyal to the other side.
Well, she was the self-labelled Queen of Fleet Street.
Yeah.
And I remember on the day of Diana, Princess of Wales' wedding to Charles, when I was a cub reporter, I'd been brought down from Manchester. I worked in the Express.
You were just a child in those
days. I was
days.
Just a child. And I was, you know, so thrilled to be part of it in the iconic Express building in Fleet Street. Everybody had to report back, you know, and you had to bring your copy in, all that kind of stuff. And then everybody was invited across the road to the Punch for a few drinks. I was mixing with the news editors and all that kind of stuff.
Such a thrill, wasn't it?
An absolute thrill. And it's a blazing hot summer's day. But the one thing I remember was going down this corridor, not knowing where I was going in the Express, and there was a door at the end, and it had a huge sign on the front of it saying, "Nobody enters here except the editor." And I said, "Who's that?" And somebody said, "Oh, that's Jean Rooke's office. She was writing the definitive colour piece on, you know, on the wedding, Charles and Di, and woe be tide you if you got in." She was so powerful, she had a better car than the editor. The editor had a certain class of Jaguar. Jean had a better one, and she used to park it deliberately outside the front of the Daily Express on a yellow line every day just to prove who she was. And it rolled up, you know, it rattled up tickets all the time, but she never paid them.
She put them on expenses.
Well, no, she didn't even pay them. The car was owned by the Daily Express, so it was somebody else's problem. Right, Leslie Ann, well, thank you very much indeed for being in the studio with me today. Very nice to have recalled a Fleet Street story there about Jean Rooke. You are, of course, folks, listening to Life on Planet Porky. And just one last thing, actually, about Jean Rooke. I think I've told this story before. She died as we were going to see her in the editor's jag. We set out to some, you know, nursing home she was in. She'd got cancer,
she
sadly.
Did, yeah, poor woman.
And we got a call halfway there to say, "I'm awfully sorry that Jean Rooke had passed away." I got on with her terrifically because she was always looking for ideas for her column, you know. And all columnists should do that. You know, columnists shouldn't just sit there and assess their own ideas. They should go walking around the newspaper, listening and talking. And I said, "Look, Jean, what about this?" "Oh, I'm not sure about that." "What about this?" "Oh, I don't know about that." "Oh, I love that," you know, and then she'd rush off and she had an idea. But then she would turn it into a beautifully written piece, you know.
Magnificent character, wasn't she?
Yeah. Now,
with a style of her own.
Now, talking about Fleet Street or newspapers generally, I want to just raise a story with you, which is rather unsavoury, but it started about a week ago, about 10 days ago, and it's going to unravel now in a big way. And I'm talking about us, the Fourth Estate, knowing things were going on which were despicable. And I'm talking now about Cyril Smith,
yes,
the MP. Not only did we know, but the police knew and other politicians knew that Cyril Smith was a serial abuser of young boys. He was a bully. He was a tyrant. He used to tell them they were being punished for bad behaviour so he could sexually assault them and all that. And this was known to people as high up in the political world as Lord David Steele, who a week ago had to step down.
Quite right too. Everybody who knew and who said nothing is as culpable as Cyril Smith.
Absolutely.
I felt very unclean when that news about him came out because when I was at school, Cyril Smith used to come to my school every summer for prize giving in Bromley in Kent.
Why would he come?
Because his constituency was Rochdale. Because he was best friends at his school in Rochdale with Miss Lovegrove, who was our headmistress.
Good
And
God.
So to do a favour to
Miss Lovegrove...
I had no
idea you had a connection.
Yeah. To do a favour to Miss Lovegrove every summer, he would come and hand out the prizes.
Right.
So my copies of War and Peace have his fingerprints on them.
Right.
And I'm rather disgusted by that.
Yes.
But, you know, you remember when Esther Ranson formed Childline?
Yes.
When she launched Childline?
Yes.
So she and Des Wilcox, her husband, were once the most powerful people at the BBC.
Yes.
They knew about Jimmy Savile. The whole of the BBC knew about Jimmy Savile.
Yeah, they did.
They were at the top of the tree.
Yes.
And they should have done something about it.
Of course
they never
should.
Did.
Of course they
and
should.
And it is said that Esther launched Childline because she felt so damn guilty.
So guilty about Jimmy Savile.
As she should about knowing about Jimmy Savile and never having said.
Yeah.
So everyone who knew about Cyril Smith is also culpable.
They're terribly culpable. Lord Steele, who, you know, came over as this gentleman Scots politician, go back to your constituencies and prepare for government. That was his famous speech.
Yeah, well, how the mighty fall.
Yeah.
I have nothing but disgust for him now.
So Private Eye, the, you know, a publication you and I are well-versed in, probably starred in a few times yourself.
Yeah,
I certainly
once
have.
Or twice.
Yeah, exactly. Started writing the stories. They were that sure. They were that sure about Cyril Smith. And Lord Stevens, not Lord Stevens, he was the former proprietor of the Daily Express. Lord Steele was asked by, you know, senior members of the Labour Party in the committee, you know, what do you think about this? He said, well, I assume it's true, because he'd asked Cyril, and Cyril Smith said, well, yeah, OK, I'll have to sort of hold my hands up. Despite that, he still recommended him to the Honours Committee for a knighthood to become Sir Cyril Smith,
it's
even
disgusting.
After he knew.
It's disgusting.
And I don't think, I think you're absolutely right. He then was allowed to go on and assault other young children. So Lord Steele should be answerable for that.
He should be inside.
Of course
for
he should.
Because he knew about it.
Of course
it
he should.
Did nothing.
Everybody knew about it, right? Everybody. Yeah. Everybody in Rochdale, everybody in the House of Commons, everyone knew about it. The perversions of Cyril Smith.
What is it about people that make them not
know.
Blow whistles? What makes
people
turn a blind eye?
Well, you know, it's such a close shot.
What is the psychology behind that?
And yet we only wasted 25 million quid on an investigation when Carl, you know, the fictional Carl.
He turned out to Nick. Well, they called him Nick, didn't
Nick
they?
Nick or Carl, whatever his name was. You know, came up with ridiculous stories about Edward Heath and Lord Bramwell and all that. All Leon Britton. All complete nonsense.
Yeah.
They spent 25 million quid, you know, examining that on the word of some fantasist, but didn't choose to respond to that Private Eye story, which they should have done.
Which is why, you know, it's why they went after every DJ since Savile.
That's right.
Because they didn't get Savile.
Yeah.
And they tried to nail quite a few people who were completely innocent.
Absolutely. But it shows a failure of the establishment because Fleet Street was on the case. Now, the reason I mention that is there was another guy involved and his name was Peter Morrison. Now, Peter Morrison became MP for Chester when I worked on the Chester Chronicle. You know, complete coincidence. Morrison was an Eton and Oxford man, graduated in law, became a barrister, then wanted to get into politics and became an MP. So I go to the opening of a health centre in Chester very early in my career as a reporter on the Chester Chronicle. And this car turns up and this bloke gets out the back and tall, handsome chap, Peter Morrison, local MP. Very impressed, you know, hello, Mr. Morrison, how are you? So I didn't know anything about Morrison. So he said several times, you know, you must come down to London and I'll give you an exclusive interview in my House of Commons office, you know, local MP and all that. And I said, this is brilliant. You know, this guy obviously, you know, spotted my talent too as a reporter. And several times I put it to the then news editor, the Chester Chronicle. We couldn't afford the rail fare, you know, to send a reporter to London. And this guy was bothering me all the time and then said, I'll pay your rail fare. You know, you must come down to me and come overnight, you know, and all this kind of stuff. Years later, Peter Morrison turned out to be a child abuser, OK? And Mrs. Thatcher, believe it or not, for whom I had enormous respect, is at fault because she was warned several times that Peter Morrison, who's now dead, by the way, just in case you're wondering, has a particular fancy for young boys, Mrs. Thatcher. She ignored it. She ignored the advice. Peter Morrison became her parliamentary private secretary, ran her campaign to make sure she didn't lose her job as prime minister when she was challenged, but failed it because he was pissed all the time. Peter Morrison, by that stage, had gone through a period of self-loathing and was drinking a bottle of vodka a day. So by midday every day, this is, you know, I know this story from my friends who've worked in the House of Commons, know the whole history. By midday every day, he was out of the game. His head had gone. He didn't organise Mrs. Thatcher's re-election campaign inside the party properly. And she lost as prime minister because she was outvoted because Morrison didn't run the campaign properly. But the point I'm making is, had the Chester Chronicle been able to afford the rail fare to London, I'd have come down to London to interview Peter Morrison.
You would have fallen victim.
I could have been sucked into a web of child abuse, literally. I mean, yeah. I was 18 or 19 years at the time, but you know what I mean? Mm. And when people know that's going on, you're absolutely right. The establishment cover-up is disgraceful.
Thatcher was warned. She did nothing.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's at fault.
Absolutely.
And she paid with her job.
Ultimately. She did, actually, because she sort of put trust in him and all that kind of stuff, okay? She just didn't. She took her eye off the ball and thought she was unbeatable and all that kind of stuff anyway. Now, I tell you what I want to talk to you about. So I've said he drank a bottle of vodka a day. What do you think the drink situation is like in this country when I read in a report from one of my health journals that drink admissions in the last 18 months to hospitals have gone up 60%? That means somebody being taken into hospital as a result of something that's been caused by drink. Not necessarily cirrhosis of the liver, not necessarily vomiting, but people stepping off the pavement in front of a car, people slipping over and breaking their hip because they're pissed, people getting into fights in bars, all drink-related. Do you think we are in the grip of an alcoholic time bomb in this country?
Yes, I do.
And do you? What makes you say that?
Because of all the reasons you've just mentioned, plus so many people that we know personally, when was the last time we saw them sober?
Well, it depends on your definition of sober, you know. It really does.
Well, we usually go for a drink, don't we?
Yeah, we go for a drink.
After we finish recording,
we
usually go to the pub or
That's
wherever
right.
and have a few drinks.
Yeah.
Now, I wouldn't consider myself an alcoholic. I never drink by myself.
No.
I never drink at home.
No.
I never drink in the morning.
No.
To what degree are people's lives so wrecked and so challenging that they need to anaesthetise themselves around the clock?
Yeah.
That's the question we should be asking.
I've mentioned this to you before, I'm sure, on one of our podcasts, that I see men of a certain age now sitting around in pubs and all they do is drink all day and play cards with each other or just talk to each other. But they go in there and they drink all day. And that was before I saw this report. But the figure that got me here was some 47% of those admitted for alcohol-related reasons in the last survey were aged between 55 and 74. That completely backs up my point. Some people who work in public services retire at 55. Policemen, firemen, doctors even. And then they start drinking full-time.
So there's a lack of point to their lives.
A lack of point to their lives. They start drinking full-time. And at 74, they're still drinking. And I agree with you. I think there is some kind of alcohol time bomb because these people are going to drink themselves to death no matter what because they've got nothing to do.
Maybe that's what they're trying to do.
The only good news is this, if you want to be moralistic about drinking, those aged 16 to 24 were responsible for only 3% of the admissions. And the report goes on further to say that you won't believe it, but those in the 16... excuse me, it's the air conditioning, in the 16 to 24 age bracket are drinking less now than ever. Do your children reflect that?
Well, interesting. So I have three children. My eldest barely drinks at all because she and her boyfriend are on a big sort of health drive.
How old is she?
She's 30.
Right.
I have a 10-year gap, and the next two children are 22 and about to be 21.
Right.
They drink themselves stupid all the time.
Do they?
They haven't been hospitalised.
Sorry, what ages are they?
22 and about to be 21.
Right, and are
they're
they
both students?
Both students, okay.
And they go out on benders. They don't remember getting back to Niall's place to spend the night or, you know, waking up in places they shouldn't be waking up, all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
All alcohol related.
And what's your attitude to that? Considering you were doing all that at their age.
I did do all that at their age, and they do remind me of that. They do say, well, come on, you were just the same. You were just like us at this age.
Yes.
Yeah, well, as long as you learn a lesson from that.
Yes.
As long as you don't do anything stupid and end up dead, you know, I'm prepared to go along with it a little bit, but don't waste your money in the pub every night.
I feel sorry for these people, this class of this underclass I've told you about, stay in the pub all day, but they do. Now, they're clearly either divorced or separated or their partner's died or whatever.
Hopeless.
Well, they just sit at the bar all day. Yeah. And some of them some of them sit at the bar all day and stare into space. Mm. Now, if I go into pubs on my own, it's for one very good reason. I've usually got a bag full of magazines, papers, you know, printed out stuff that I need to read, because my whole life is about acquiring information to do things like these podcasts, to go on radio and TV and talk about things. If I know I'm doing an interview tomorrow, I read up on it today, as you would, you know, and as you've done all your life. But these people sit there and with a drink in front of them and stare into space, occasionally talk to the barman or the barmaid, occasionally talk to somebody who's passing. There's one woman that I see sometimes, and it's a pub near to a railway station, so I'm not in there all the time, but sometimes when I've got off the train, you know, fancy quick drink and all that. Doesn't matter what time of day or night it is. This woman has, what can I say, a permanent role, you know, a permanent place in the boozer, okay? It's permanently hers.
She's got her own seat.
Got her own seat.
Oh,
nobody else
God.
Comes in. A car brings her in the morning and a car arrives to take her home at night because she has an infirmity. You know, I don't know what it is, but, you know.
Oh, okay. She's disabled in some way.
In some way. And the car, I think, is provided by the social services.
The pub.
Well, no, it's not by the pub. No. Although, I mean, that always makes me laugh.
Well, maybe it is. Maybe she's their best customer and, you know, they lay on the ride for her.
I mean, people who put on cars for you are casinos, because I've had mates in the past who have been high rollers
at
casinos.
Well, that's when you know that you're doing the wrong thing, isn't it?
And, you know, you say, oh, there's a car downstairs there for you, Jack, or somebody like that. You know, oh, yeah, that's from the, you know, the Palm Beach or something like that. I said, sorry, what's it? Oh, yeah, you know, I'm well in there now. You know, they send a car for me now.
I'm
thinking,
beginning
they send
of the
a
end.
Car for you because you're dropping
wasting
five
all your
grand
money
a night
you.
on the blinking tables in the
Idiots.
Club. You know, are you mad? And then, of course, guess what? When you've gone bankrupt and you've got no more money to lose.
No more car.
Exactly. The car stops turning up. You're absolutely right. But, you know, what we talked about, drinking, gambling. The only thing we don't talk about anymore, Leslie Ann, is the old shagging bit because, I mean, you know, let's face it, that's a history.
Well, which, speak for yourself.
Well, OK, I'll speak for myself then. Sorry, folks.
I'm not
folks.
Washed up here yet.
I'm not suggesting...
I'm very choosy, though.
I know you're very choosy.
I'm waiting for Mr. Wright as can be.
Mr. Wright as can be, that's right. This is a family show, folks, but, you know, we like to cover all these subjects, but... Leslie Ann, of course, has been a woman in demand most of her life. In fact, probably all of her life. Whereas demand for the Portmeister here has sort of gone up and down
over the decades.
They're
still lusting after you, mate.
No, I don't put myself down. Right, OK, so there we are. So, folks, thanks very much once again for joining us. I saw a stat this week, by the way, which drove me mad as well, and that was, you know, all the stormy weather we've had lately.
Stormy weather,
the winds and all that.
Yeah.
What about this? All those wind farms they have, right?
Oh, don't. We're going to do wind farms again.
All these windmills, right? Now, this is a very recent fact. So during the recent winds, guess what? The winds were too strong to allow the windmills, well, they're not called windmills, what are they called?
Wind farm things.
Yeah, well, you know.
Those white things that stick out of the sea.
That's right. You know, that look like the things children used to blow on in fairgrounds.
Windmills.
You know what I mean? Windmills, that's right, yeah. They had to switch them off because the winds were too strong. And they might have broken the windmills if the wind had started blowing them.
Well, what
they'd
does
have
that
blown
tell
them
you?
Too fast.
Wasting money.
And guess what? It cost £30 million in subsidies, which has to be paid by the consumer, right? Which had to be paid to the people who operate them for non-operation.
So you might as well use electricity in the first place. Which would cost a lot less.
30 million quid, okay?
Yeah, it's pointless.
That had to be given back to the non-operative nature of these windmills because the wind had blown too hard.
Nice
that,
idea, guys.
Yeah, I know. That's why I absolutely hate it. Oh, and the last thing I was going to tell you was, in a podcast a few weeks ago, we talked about the Whitney Houston show.
Oh, the hologram, yeah.
The hologram.
Did you see the pictures?
I saw a review of it. It looked dreadful.
Well, it's freaky. Absolutely
freaky.
Yeah.
It looked dreadful. All the reviews I saw of it said it was hopeless.
And because the backing singers, the BVs, and the band and everybody else can't keep time with a hologram. Because, yeah, you know, there's no live interaction going on there.
Well, I saw a picture of them kneeling and bowing and looking towards her like she was a figure like Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
But the hologram itself looked as though it was far too long and not wide enough. It looked ridiculous.
Yeah, I thought that too, yeah.
Yeah, I thought the whole thing looked ridiculous. But there you are.
We saw the real thing. We don't need the hologram.
No, absolutely right.
God rest her soul.
God rest her soul indeed. Okay, Leslie Ann, thank you very much once again for joining us. Just
my
to
pleasure.
Remind everybody to get a hold of you.
On Twitter. At LAJ Writer.
That's right. I'm Mike Parry 8. We do, of course, have a communication line, which is podcast. No, it isn't. It's Planet. Right, yeah, get this right.
I love this bit.
PlanetPorkyPod@gmail.com.
All right.
Right. And let us remind you, please, although we have done a couple of times, there are still a few tickets available for the Sunday afternoon show, which is Sunday, April the 5th at the Hen and Chickens in Islington, North London. It will be an afternoon of merriment, okay?
Please come.
Turn
Looking
Sunday
forward to meeting you.
Into fun day. And the tickets for that, folks, you'll find at Planet Porky. Just keep looking. Once again, folks, thank you very much indeed. And thank you very much indeed, Leslie Ann.
Thank you.
Back with you soon. We'll be talking about drinking, gambling. The only thing we don't talk about anymore, Leslie Ann, is the old shagging bit because, I mean, you know, let's face it, that's a history.
Well, which, speak for yourself.
Well, OK, I'll speak for myself then. Sorry,
I'm
folks.
I'm not washed up here yet.
I'm not
I'm very choosy, though.
I know you're very choosy.
I'm waiting for Mr.
Wright as can be, that's right. This is a family show, folks, but, you know, we like to cover all these subjects, but... Leslie Ann, of course, has been a woman in demand most of her life, in fact, probably all of her life, whereas demand for the Portmeister here has sort of gone up and down
over the
decades.
They're still lusting after you, Mike.
No, I don't put myself down.
So they swore allegiance to the channel who originally brought them in.
Absolutely.
You can't do it.
Absolutely.
You've got to be
cutthroat.
Instead
of to the production company that made it, you know what I mean?
You've got to be cutthroat. You've got to go with the show that made you.
So,
it's an unfortunate thing, but
it's terrible. It's happened to me. You know, I've thought I'm going to show loyalty here, and you make a decision and you lose an opportunity, and then you find that was a wrong mistake, because sometimes you do it to be loyal to somebody else in the business.
No such thing as loyalty.
Who then 3 weeks later suddenly, bonf, the knife's in your back and you're out. You know what I mean?
Gene Rook famously said,
"Yes,
always cross the street for more money."
Was she married to anybody else at
no,
the time?
No, she wasn't.
Was Brian?
Yes, he was married to Chrissy.
Who's Chrissy? Sorry.
His wife.